This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hello and welcome to the 1912 Exiles podcast, the new Book County podcast made by the fans for the fans. You'll have to forgive us for not bringing you much by way of match reaction to Saturday's game against Barrow. We will cover it, though, probably next weekend when we discuss the Bradford game. But instead, we wanted to have a bit of a deep dive into off-the-field matters ahead of the big trust vote on the 28th of September, week on Thursday. We are recording this on Monday night. Obviously, at this stage, we're still a little bit in the dark about who the preferred bidder is, what their vision for the club might be, or what role they might envisage for the trust and the fans under their ownership. And we may not even know the answers to some of those questions until the meeting itself, at which point we'll have to evaluate things very, very quickly before casting our votes. But what we can do at this point, and what we wanted to do as a podcast, is to talk a little bit about some of the principles that are at stake with this mooted change of ownership of Newport County. What are the relative merits of fan ownership versus private ownership? What does a hybrid model mean in reality? And how much of a say do we think that fans and the trust might have in any new structure? And I'm delighted to be joined by two podcast debutants who've got some excellent insights that will hopefully help us to answer some of those questions. So firstly, I'm joined by Nigel Dutson, who was chair of the Supporters Trust from 2010 until 2013 and has first-hand experience of grappling with some of these issues. Good evening to you, Nigel.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome onto the pod. And we've also got Gareth Lehman, who wrote a really excellent article giving an objective and dispassionate analysis of the issue of giving up fan ownership. And there's a link to it in the show notes. So welcome to you as well, Gareth.
Yeah, good evening. Cheers, Ed.
Before we get going properly, it'd be really nice just to hear a little bit about each of you and your journey as county fans. So, Nigel, why don't you start us off? What was your first county game and what's been your favourite county memory?
Good Lord. We go way back to 1967, I'm afraid, when my father with a group of friends used to go to a football game. So on that particular Saturday, I went to watch Workington at home, a 1-0 win, if I remember rightly. My memory of it, lots and lots of rain, the track around the outside of the ground flooded, the ball floating as they were trying to take a corner. But the smell of the cigarettes, the crowd, the feeling of sort of comradeship, which was something that got me as interested in football, really, as the game itself. It was that feeling of, companionship. My dad with his four mates and stuff like that.
It's funny, isn't it? The smells of football have changed over the years. I mean, a little bit like you, I remember as a child going to games and the smell of cigarette smoke, and in particular the smell of cigar smoke, immediately transports me to being on a football terrace. And you know, whilst the smoking ban has been a good thing probably in terms of our general health, it does mean that now football grounds just smell of kind of burgers and body odour, and it's not quite as attractive or redolent in the same way. So great. And what about your favourite county memory, Nigel?
It's got to be promotion back to the Football League. Yeah, there are some great goals I remember along the way. Tony Buck scoring very, very early on in my time of watching them, which was sort of made me sort of always want to shout his name out when I was playing down the park thereafter. But it's got to be going back to the Football League. It was 25 years of hate, planning, pushing, and then to actually finally achieve it. It's just unbelievable, really.
And how about you, Gareth?
I've got incredibly vague memories of probably, must have been the first year or two at Spitty was my sort of first time watching County, but the what game and circumstances that was probably kind of, yeah, lost to time, really. But aside from that, I'm a bit of a Johnny come lately, to be honest. It's not until I moved back to Newport a few years ago that I really started coming along and watching games properly. So that would have been start of the 17-18 season. So just after the Great Escape, which I watched from afar before being around again. And Chesterfield first game. And yeah, they say first impressions of a player is everything. Frank Newbley scored.
I was going to say, Newbley scored a banger in that as well, didn't he?
He's got a hat trick in about 15 minutes, I think. So yeah, first impressions. He's always always going to be a County legend in my eyes. But yeah, I'm part of that kind of lost generation of County fans for whom, like, you know, growing up in Newport in the sort of early 90s, they just weren't on the radar of anybody I played football with, anybody I went to school with. So it's quite a recent thing, and you can see that on the terraces a lot. It's like people younger than myself, older than myself, there's a big sort of gap in the middle that shows what happens when a football club can sort of disappear off people's radars for, you know, best part of two decades. So yeah, kind of apt for what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I was going to say that brings us quite neatly really onto some of the predictions of doom if County fans and trust members don't vote in favour of the change of ownership next week. So I mean, let's get onto it and the big decision that we've all got to help take a week on Thursday. And I want to throw it open to both of you to kind of set your stall out a little bit. I mean, from what I know and what I've seen of both of your views, I think all of us hold quite dear the romantic notion of fan ownership and see that as something that County fans and football fans generally should be reluctant to give up, but equally are conscious of the pragmatic challenges that County face. So hopefully we're all coming at this from a standpoint of healthy scepticism, but open to the arguments. I hope I'm not kind of putting words into anyone's mouths, but I suspect that's probably the position a lot of County fans are in at the moment. So set out your stalls a little bit. What's in your mind as we approach next week's vote, and what are the factors at play in deciding which way you might go? Do you want to start us off, Gareth?
Yeah, I mean, the feeling I've got at the moment, first and foremost, is just how sort of rushed and desperate things have become in what feels like quite a short period of time. So in like, I don't know, about last six months or so, we seem to have gone from a point of sort of the sound financial footing. We sort of coped with COVID better than a lot of teams. We're punching above our weights, given the budget that we were working with. And then all of a sudden, you know, pre-season comes along, or tail end of last season, and it's a case of this can't continue in its current state. We need to sort of move on as soon as we can, or the club sort of risks going to the wall. So yeah, it's been really difficult to just take a breath and fully get to grips with what is actually at stake here with the rush of information, the change in circumstances. So key sort of question that I'm stuck with at the moment isn't just should we sell or who should we be selling to, but do we have to? I don't feel like that has been fully established, how desperate the situation is, whether it is a case of we need to do this now or the club risks financial oblivion. I feel like we're not coming from a sound place of having the full information and being able to make that decision.
I mean, that's definitely something that has been said a lot is, you know, County fans are faced with this kind of Hobson's choice of we either have to take the offer that is on the table. And I think at the moment we're expecting to only hear from one preferred bidder rather than, you know, a couple of offers if they are there. And that if we don't accept the offer that is on the table, then a bleak future awaits and, you know, County can't pay their bills and so on and so forth. Now, I wondered, Nigel, as someone who has been a chair of the trust in the past and has been a lot closer to these issues than most of us ever will be, I just wondered kind of what your perspective on that is and whether things are as bleak as we're being told they are.
I have little doubt that they are bleak. The fact, I think we probably stumbled through the end of last season. They didn't want to get the bad news out until the interim period between the two seasons. And I suspect we are going to be very, very short of money and that that it's probably not sustainable. I also suspect that the directors have probably run out of steam. And for those that have been around the club for a long while, you can walk around the dark corridors of the Hazel Stand to see ex-directors nursing cups of tea and not pushing past you to get back involved. It's a role that sucks the life out of you. I say this to my wife, who works in charity jobs and stuff, that people seem to have a life of about 3 to 5 years. And after that, the hoil goes out of them and it becomes very difficult to keep dusting yourself off and going again and again. I've no doubt that there are issues. I just question, a bit like Gareth, whether we've actually addressed all the possible ways in which those issues could be addressed.
Just on that point about volunteers and people wanting to put themselves forward to the board and board running out of steam, because it's something that I've talked about, I think, on the pod before and have certainly thought about a lot, is the fact that, you know, we are now in this situation. Is that partly down to the fact that every year when the Trust AGM would come round, it would generally be quite poorly attended? When there were elections, you'd often have fewer people putting themselves forward than there were spaces available. And so, you know, in what were, quote unquote, the good times, when we were being told that there was money around and we were being run sustainably and we didn't have anything to worry about, people really weren't paying that much interest in the goings on of the Trust and certainly weren't putting themselves forward to get involved in it. And then now, when we find ourselves in a difficult situation, people are very quick to kind of point fingers, but when they could have got involved and supported things, they didn't. I just wondered, like, what your take on that is, as someone, again, who's been close to it all.
The theory should be that there should be two rings of power. And so at the top, you've got the directors of the club that take on roles to do the financial, the commercial, the general day-to-day running, health and safety. And below that should be a circle of trust committee as well. And they should feed up into the board of directors as those spaces become available, as people retire or run out of steam. And I don't think that lower tier has ever been properly looked after or maintained. And whilst we were doing swimmingly, that's when we should have been working really, really hard to make sure that we had trust membership numbers growing on the back of our success. And that would have provided regular income through the whole of the season, because obviously a club struggles in the 2 months when we're not playing football. By having trust members feeding in, that gives you your wages to pay between the games. And I just feel that we've now been caught out by that and we're flat-footed, and the guys at the top are probably sat there looking very tired, worn out with it, and you're starting to make quick decisions because you want to offload the issue. I would agree with Gareth on that. I do think there's more that could have been done or should have been looked at, really.
And just on that then, if we do find ourselves in the situation where, at least as we're being told, it's take the offer or we're in real trouble, if we were to go for the nuclear option, say, no, we want to stick with fan ownership come what may, how, and I suppose this may be a question for you, Gareth, because you talked about some of these practical issues in your piece, how do we address that kind of 300,000 a year structural deficit that the club faces, because that feels like a real thing, no matter how much many of us would like to wish it away.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? That's where reality or practicality pulls even the most romantic of people towards giving it up. It is, there's no getting around that shortfall, really, is it? I'm not sure where that could come from, really, to be honest. It's, you're talking, yeah, something that grows generationally, really, that is like, it's a season long fix that we need. If you can't live off hand to mouth,
that kind of financial black hole that we were able to plug very successfully for a while with cup runs is the thing that unless we suddenly have another blinding cup run, or can sell Will Evans for several million pounds, which doesn't feel massively likely, you know, that's the short term challenge. So again, to kind of look to you, Nigel, if we do have to therefore look to accept some private investment as a way to stave off that initial and immediate short-term challenge, how do we do that in a way that still protects the fans' moral investment, if you like, within the club?
First off, it won't totally solve our issue, but if we increased our trust membership up to about 2,500 each paying a monthly fee, we could knock off about 50% of that debt straight away. I would love to see the club pushing trust membership more and more. The people that all sit around me are ex-trust members who thought that they weren't being listened to, or there wasn't any point in doing it. And I think it's not a fix, but it would increase our flow of money.
Just on that point, that point about increasing trust membership and trust donations, which you know, we can all agree is a thing that would be good to see happen. It's something that really interests me, because one of the things that's been talked about with the hybrid model is that, as well as having private investors come in and bring some money to put into the club, the trust will need to continue its donations towards the club's running costs. And at the last meeting, I think it was said that, you know, the aim of the trust should be to maintain its investment of £100,000 every season. I think it's a really fundamental question whether that is realistic, just maintaining that current level of trust support, never mind increasing it. Because, you know, I'm already seeing a lot of people saying, well, if we get millionaires coming in and taking over majority stake in the club, I'm not going to keep my 5, 10, 20 quid a month going in. Mm. And whilst I don't necessarily agree with that as a sentiment, I can understand why people might take that view. So, I mean, you know, you're talking about we should be looking to grow the trust to kind of 2,000, 2,500 members. But are we not going to have the opposite battle of just trying to maintain the 1,100 or so that we've got at the moment?
In my view, you can't be partially pregnant. So if we go into private ownership, why would you bother to invest as a fan? I don't see it. The only thing that interests me, and I don't fully understand this, I was talking to my friend Tony Pring a couple of days ago. Obviously, he has an interest in Carl Zeiss Jena. And there is a model in Germany that maintains that the club has to be owned by the fans for 51%. And I don't fully understand how that structure works in Germany, but all of those clubs, including RB Leipzig, are 50% owned by fans. So there must be a way of keeping some fan control in place, even when hideously large amounts of money are being chucked at clubs like Leipzig.
Yeah, and you know, within Spain as well, there are models that see fans have, you know, a democratic, say, kind of one member, one vote within elements of how the club is run.
And Barcelona. Yeah,
exactly. I think it's something that you talked about in your article again, Gareth, is about this issue of if we are to accept private investment, how do we use the short-term money that's going to come in through private investment and the renewed sense of energy around the club? How do we use that to kind of reimagine what we do as a club within its community, and how do we make sure that the fans' voice within that remains strong and meaningful?
Yeah, that is one of the sort of alarm bells for me with the hybrid model, is this demand for supporters to still make a financial contribution without having majority control is that fans end up acting as a sort of financial guarantor of the club's existence without any of the control that full ownership would give you. So the new owners, they can sort of come and go as they please. We're the ones that are footing the bill, as it were, at the end of the day. So it sounds like, yeah, the worst of both worlds in one sense. But there's also the possibility, if we continue keeping up that financial contribution, to use that as leverage as much as we can to make sure we are exerting an influence over the owners.
I mean, how might we use that leverage for, you know, to improve things? Because I thought this was one of the things I thought was most compelling about your article was actually it's not just about who owns what. It's about what sort of club do we want to be and how can we try to use this decision that we're grappling with at the moment and the conversations around it. How can we use that to try and reimagine the sort of club that Newport County is? So I don't know, you expand on that for me.
Yeah, and perhaps that is a, you know, a demand that could be made or a question that could be asked at the upcoming meeting or in future conversations with new ownership, is that, yeah, we can have some say in how that money gets spent or what the club will be. That's what this whole situation feels like. It's a bit of a referendum on what you want a football club to be, whether it's a social enterprise or a commercial one. But we can have some say in that. We can have some influence in that by say, you know, if we're going to continue to contribute hundreds of thousands of pounds a year, some of that should be going towards laying down some tangible infrastructure for the club.
I mean, that for me is the biggest worry with the whole thing. It's not that the people we've got interested in the club at the moment aren't good, honourable people who want the best for Newport County. I have no doubt at all that they do. The problem is that once you give up 51% of ownership of the club, you can't control who that good person then sells to. And yeah, you can quite easily find yourself in a situation, as many clubs have, where a good owner sells to a not so good owner, who sells to an even worse owner, who sells to a right wrong un. And then suddenly you're in a Jerry Sherman type situation, and you once again, then it ends up being the fans who have to bail you out next time round. And I think I saw you, Nigel, kind of saying something along those lines. You know, if you look at experiences of plenty of other clubs, including some within our own league.
I could sort of give you a list, really, but Gretna, remember yeah. Gretna yeah, being yeah. An enterprise by a guy who fancied a bit of a hobby, forced them through the Scottish leagues, and then sadly died of a heart attack. And his wife looked at the accounts when she'd buried him and said, "Good Lord, I don't want anything to do with football. I don't like football." And that was the end of Gretna, just gone like that. You could say the same with Hornchurch, who started a rush through the non leagues, and then the window business went out of business and Hornchurch went with it. Or Colne Dynamos, again, rocketed through the league so much so that Burnley fans were worried about them. And then he started to get abuse at home, and his children were being bullied at school, so he withdrew his funding from the club. And I only use those as examples to show that it isn't just about somebody selling on. There are circumstances that happen to private owners that mean that they can no longer invest in your football club. So you are at the behest of one person, and that worries me. Whereas as a fan-owned club, our supporters are spread wide. So if one stops paying, it doesn't really affect the general overall input into the club. So I like the idea of that community-based thing. As a proud Welshman and person from South East Wales, the Chartists, the working together, the community feel of South East Wales, I think it sits well with our club, and it's obviously sits well with quite a few of the Welsh clubs, because Wrexham had supporters trusts and Swansea. It was the supporters trust that drove them from 2002 onwards. So that, you know, there is some historical background to it. It makes something about where this club comes from.
And just to unpack one point a little bit, because, as you know, I said at the top, we're not going to get into the specific details of the bids, partly because we don't know them, but also because I think it's more interesting to have a discussion about some of the general principles. But I do just want to ask this one point, because There have been apparently two, you know, major bids that came in. And as I understand it, the one that we see next week will be the one offer that the existing trust board decide is the preferred bidder. And that person will get to outline their the details of their bid and their vision to us. But, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, look, if there's two bids that have made it to this point, should we not hear from both of those bids, at least so that we can compare and contrast a little bit, you know, and it, we can still know which one is the recommended or preferred bid. But is there a danger, do either of you think, that by only having one bid in front of us, that whatever happens 12 months down the line, there will always be people who will say, well, we should have gone with the other guy. Why did they never get to be in front of us? And I just wondered, and again, you perhaps may be in a better position to answer this, Nigel, the thinking behind that and the potential implications of it.
It's always a line to be drawn where, you know, fans say, well, we want to know what the players' wages are, why so-and-so wasn't paid more, what we got for a sale. That has to be private and that has to be kept within the business. However, as our representatives at board level, I think the trust members deserve to at least know the outlines of what the two offers were and a broad outline on why one offer was chosen above the other. Now, it may just be scanty details such as one offered more money or it was a sounder proposition, but at least I think that explanation should be given to us rather than, like you said, a black hole, a question mark just hanging over the whole offer. And it just leaves you open to just ongoing queries and questions, which would be best quashed now, I would feel.
It does feel like it puts an unnecessary amount of pressure on the situation. It turns it into a bit more of a take it or leave it, sort of do or die situation where it's this is who we've chosen. It's this or nothing. I'm not sure why we've gone down that road. I don't know whether it's at the request of the prospective parties. I don't know. I just feel like everything has been funneled towards the taking of the vote, pointing it towards going for the private option is the kind of default. Whereas it's a question of where the risk lies. It just becomes a 50-50 thing, like stay or go. And it muddies the water of what we're actually talking about here.
Before I come back to you both for some, you know, sort of closing thoughts, we did put this out to listeners at the back end of last week, I think, and said, you know, for you as fans of the club and trust members potentially, what's the biggest factor that will determine how you cast your vote? And we had some really interesting responses, and I think it's worth going through them. So in no particular order, Hamid, friend of the pod, said the reputation of the prospective owners and ideally previous experience of managing a professional sports club. Ollie said, I'm interested to see what the 3, 5, and 10 year plans look like. It's all well and good coming in and spending a bit of money now, but how much will be spent down the line? Will they look for the club to become self-sufficient? And will we be reliant on player sales? I think really good point there about how do you make this model sustainable so that we're not having to look for yet further private investment just down the line. Andy Lawrence said, honestly, for me, as long as it's a sound businessman, such as Hugh Jenkins, David Buttress, John Pratt, etc., the rest will fall into place. The board already have indicated the people are known. In short, as long as it's not a random consortium in the style of Crawley and a sound proposal, then it's a yes from me. So he's one of the more enthusiastic people. I thought this was a really good point from Ian Richards on Twitter. Probably not the biggest factor, but for me, it'll be important how much value the new people place on the off the field stuff, county and the community, outreach in schools, etc. It shows whether they see us as being more than just a football club. And I think this was something, Gareth, that you wrote about, you know, about those community links being really important.
Yeah, I think with us, it's a genuine thing. It's almost more reason for the football club existing than anything that goes on the pitch in a way. But that comes back to that question of what a football club is, whether it's a social endeavour for a social good of the community or a commercial one. I would like to think those things will continue. There's something really to be proud of to just do those things because they're good things to be doing.
I just want to go through a few more listener comments. So Simon James, a little bit like Ollie, said he wants to know the now, soon, later plan. How do we consolidate and build on our foundation? Anthony Evans, who's the first one to make this point about the stadium. We need something that gives us long-term security, whether that's a long lease, a joint partnership, or an opportunity to have a stake in Rodney Parade. It gives us opportunities to grow the club into something sustainable. And then, again, we also had a load of people on Facebook. It seemed to me people on Facebook were slightly more hawkish in terms of wanting private investment than Twitter, where it's a bit more nuanced. So on Facebook, Pamela said, we change and change now. I can see an iceberg ahead. Chris Collins, I want to be sure that the person or persons that take over the club are in for the long haul. Tony Carver, promises need to be written into the contract and have a resale clause. So, yeah, the uncertainty, I think, a concern for him. Chris Davis, who's been very vocal about this, was talking about the fact it's a one-horse race. We don't know the names of the other runners, which we kind of covered. So before we wrap up, chaps, I want to give you each of you a sort of chance to draw some conclusions, really, based on some of what we've said and other things that you've been thinking and conversations that you've had. And I suppose to answer that same question that we put out to fans, what's the biggest factor for you as we come around to next week's vote? What would be the thing foremost in your mind as you decide which way you're going to go? So, Nigel, I'll come to you first.
I need to be sold to. And what I want to hear is that there is a plan, and the plan that we can't currently talk our way round or visualise is how the supporters fit in with their vision for the following 5-10 years. And if they can really sell it to me that there is some future where us as a community club, us as supporters, but also our club and its current status can be maintained and run in a way that I would feel comfortable with, then I would be willing to move away from my scepticism. At the moment, I can't imagine what that plan is, which probably is my fault, not theirs. And the rumour is, of course, that it may be some group based around the crowd that took over Swansea. And if that is the case, they would have an understanding of how trusts could bed in. Although I suspect they'd also point that no trust club has ever played above League One, isn't it? Because obviously Exeter have gone up and so did Wimbledon. But there is a question mark about whether the trust formula works at the higher level once you get just silly money involved. And so I've already booked my place at the meeting, and that's what I'd be looking to want to hear. Something that makes me think, oh, I can see that, that'll work, and they will then get my backing.
None of the people who are being mentioned are names that you would say are problematic. You know, Hugh Jenkins had experience at Swansea, David Buttress, involved obviously with the Dragons, John Pratt, you know, businessman from Newport. You know, they're all wealthy individuals and they've all got different things to recommend them. And so in that sense, it comes back to what I said before, all of the options potentially are good ones. So it isn't so much about, are we selling to people who are capable? It's about the principle, which is why we have this discussion of what is the long-term plan and how do we make sure that the fan voice remains a meaningful one.
The one asset we haven't got is a ground.
Yeah.
And so that alters what is the normal problem with people being interested in your club, is that you are eventually going to find a block of flats on there in 10 years' time. In theory, at the moment, that isn't going to be an issue. So they should be coming to us with just a love of football and what they can do with a football club. That's my hope.
Yeah. How about you, Gareth?
For me, it's about establishing which direction carries the greater risk, really. You've got the risk on the one hand of going for the private direction, and in which case we end up in a like it or lump it situation with we're just along for the ride. At that point, we can just sit back and hope that the owners do right by the football club, but we've got no real meaningful influence over that. So is it worth the risk of letting the club loose into the world and hoping for the best versus the risk of can we as a supporter base, as a community club, do what is necessary in terms of finances and organization to keep the club going. And that to me feels less of a risk in terms of us having full control over that situation. It is up to us to make that work. Whether it's realistic at this point for us to make that work is a whole other question. So I think for me, if I decide to go with the voting in favor of selling up, it'll be pushed from that direction rather than being pulled towards any sort of promises that are coming our way. And I think it's important to think about as well, as you both alluded to, that we only get to make this decision once. We are only deciding who this owner is going to be. What happens after that is we're just hostages to fortune after that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's about what is the meaningful voice that fans retain in the club and how meaningful that is. I think that will be critical. And because we aren't going to have a lot of time to think about this, right? As I understand it, we may get a bit of information ahead of the meeting, but most likely we will get the opportunity at the meeting to hear a little bit more about their vision, ask some questions and try and interrogate and kick the tires of the proposal. But we then basically have to vote straight away. So it will be partly about how candid they are. If there are things that are left for future determination, then that won't give me a huge amount of faith. I think we need to know in a lot of detail what's being proposed so that we can have confidence in it.
I really just, yeah, want to make sure that the offer that is given to us is well looked at and has had due diligence run over it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, both of you, thank you very much for coming on and having this conversation. I'll give you an opportunity to finish with any shout outs or beefs. So Gareth, any shout outs, any beefs?
Well, to bring it back to sort of on-field matters slightly, there's a big shout out to Graham Coughlin and the coaching staff and whoever was responsible for appointing them. I know, the board come in for a lot of flack, some warranted maybe, some not warranted, but I think they completely nailed that decision because I don't think we could have had a better manager for the situation we find ourselves in at the moment. And I think, if we were coming to this vote propping up the table as a lot of people expected us to be at this point, the vote would seem even more desperate.
Excellent. How about you, Nigel?
As a person that queued at a gig for about an hour to get in while somebody manually checked all our tickets, I'd like to shout out to our ticket entry system with the readers on the mobile phones. It's fantastic. No more trying to burst your 16 stones through the turnstile. Just a quick flash of the mobile phone and you're in. I think it's brilliant. And whoever sourced that and it actually works, fantastic.
There we go. And neither of you have any beefs. This is a first for the pod if we're beefless.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I was feeling quite diplomatic, I think. I don't know. We could go for the low-lying fruit of the standard of officiating in League Two after the weekend that kind of dominated.
God,
but I mean, I'm ironically contributing to it because I'm just so bored that is the outcome of a lot of League Two games.
I have one beef. I'd just like to have a weekly or monthly announcement of what our trust membership numbers are. Please tell us. It drives enthusiasm. So if it starts to rise, other people think it's worth something joining.
That's a very, very good point. Well, maybe we'll get an update next week at the meeting about what the current number is. Yeah. Thank you both, Nigel and Gareth, for coming onto the pod. And thanks to all of you, as always, for listening. Don't forget, you can support the pod by donating the price of a cup of coffee to us at our Ko-fi account. There's a link in the show notes. And you can also leave us nice reviews wherever you get your podcast from. We will be back with a look at On The Pitch Matters soon, hoping to record something after the Bradford game at the weekend. But until then, look after yourselves, look after each other, and as always, keep it Canty.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.